abstract level, right? Here we're saying this, of course I want that for my daughter, right? Then, you know, she has this boy that she's seeing, and, you know, I think, like, he's so immature, and, you know, he's like, right, and what else is he doing? Where else is he going? What else is he doing, you know, and doesn't, you know, the whole issue is what's going to happen to her, and people have a very difficult time, and I think our educational programs and everything don't help they don't help girls and boys to begin to see sexuality as something natural, something that they have to gain control over themselves.
But what springs to mind for me, somebody who does that kind of work, is AIDS will change all that for me.
Yes.
I mean, come on, I have to let this go and tell this girl, look, you could die, okay? You have to use this.
Well, when I started out in seeing pregnancy and sexuality, where, as I was telling you all, when I switched over to doing more of that in 1984, I had much more of the attitude that you expressed. And certainly my attitude has been very much affected by the rise of AIDS in teens, and also by what I know about adolescents and adolescent development, which is that they don't follow through, that they believe each other, that, you know, that they love less for 2 months, that a whole range of things, and that whole issue of cognitive development and being able to make decisions and everything, and the tremendous consequences. In two of the places that I work, we just did a Linac Projects, the syphilis rate is higher than it was before, among teenagers, is higher than it was before penicillin. Okay, so that's what I was saying.
Right.
So that's what I was going to say about how if we started on STDs, I would be taking a different view. I'd be talking much more about sexuality.
What's being said by Mother is very moving here. There are some things about it, though, that I think there's another sort of angle on. One is that I've done a lot of interviews with teenage girls. If you tell a teenage girl to have sex, when in fact they wanted it, when desire arose, that's quite a delay right in there. Because it takes a long time to develop desire, to have it be the time when you're comfortable, all of those things. It's quite a developmental experience in itself. So the permission and the statistics,
that's
I think, show
important.
It. Permission acts as a retarding factor. The other thing is this cognitive development stuff, which I think actually ties into girl education. Because these articles indicate that at age 16, girls do not have the cognitive ability to make cause and effect and read probability. Now, this isn't likely, I mean, because we know they can read their own futures, right in front of their eyes and make all kinds of decisions about what they're going to do now because they have no future, because they do. It's clear. They have quite a political, economic understanding of the world. But I do think there are educational things in elementary school and junior high school about cause and effect and about probability, what it means that you only have a 4% chance of getting pregnant, how that can turn out to mean that there's a very good likelihood that you can get pregnant or you'll die from that drug. That those really teaching kids how to think and how to then make their own decisions is something that this educational system is rarely doing. And that's the job.
Yes.
It's not that they're not developmentally ready to make those simple, really sort of
right.
not taught sexual responsibility. And you can't teach it by going in and giving a lecture this afternoon.
That's also
you start in kindergarten and you build on it and you keep building on it until and then they can really make a responsible decision. And that's what the countries that have good programs do. They start early and they keep building on that.
Right.
Decision making, self-esteem, all of those things. All of that's a part of sexuality.
Yeah, can I just disagree with you on one thing. I agree with you about the adolescent development at 16. But in the surveys that we've done on numbers of our seventh grade programs, over 60% of the kids are sexually active in seventh grade. I think there's a real, that they have had sexual intercourse.
Actual penetration you talk about.
They define as having sex.
Yeah, that's always the other question that I've
got. Sexual, I mean, you could
What is it that they are actually physically doing?
have so much.
Because I know how long as an adult woman it took me to actually understand the mechanics, the biology of my body, to understand what was happening. And so when you said there was a penetration in the course, I mean, how do you?
But you know, I was really, you know, being an endocrinologist, you know, I thought I knew all about glands. And so I had really, I was talking about the mean age of onset of puberty and all of this. But one of the things I think we need to stop and think about is back in the early part of the century, the mean age of onset of puberty was 17 years. Mm-hmm. Now it's 11 and a half. Mm-hmm. It's dropping 4 months every 10 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a real problem. So our children are really able to be sexually active an awful lot earlier. And I really get to start talking about the mean age for boys and the mean age for girls. This past year, I did some physicals in a school doing a school-based clinic, and I was shocked at how developed the junior high schoolers were. Now, I might have gotten all the ninth graders rather than the seventh graders.
No, but I think that, you know, sexually active is a stupid term in many ways. Yeah. It's just the one that we have that has any survey data on it, and that's kids who say they've had sexual intercourse.
And
they say they've had sexual intercourse. It's very difficult to get any information about. Seventh grade schools are not really up for having people ask these kinds of questions. But in the programs, now I'm talking about inner city junior high school. It's the only place that I have these programs.
You have to also think 13% of white girls have been sexually abused by the time they're 18. And 11% or so of black girls, maybe it's 9 or 10, I forgot, but 8% of black boys and 6% of white boys have been sexually abused. So, you know, if you're talking about the...
Mm-hmm. So they've had some kind of sexual intercourse.
So don't you think it's very stupid then, you know, to have all these kind of pressures on these kids and not say that they are now available? Girls today have to watch their priests, they have to watch their fathers, they have to watch their brothers.
They've got to watch the minister and the cop.
Yes. That's right. They're desperate now.
That's right. You know. And, if the average child abuser will be abused 250 different children in the course of their lifetime.
And it's usually people that have killed
children. Usually people that they have.
Well, I'm sorry, what did you want
to say? I wanted to return to the point that you were, as much as we ignore sexuality, I think that when we talk about it, often we run the risk of separating it from everything else. So that you were talking about, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could say to our children that not only can you have satisfying relationships and an exciting life and all of these things, but you can also have sexuality too. I think the converse is equally important. I don't think it's realistic to expect that young women will have an ability to take control over their sexuality if we deprive them of the ability to take control over any other aspect of their life. And if we educate young women in a way that essentially disempowers them in every other aspect of their life, but give them sexuality education, we're giving them really conflicting messages.
Partly it's because it's somewhat of an issue of describing conditions and talking about strategies, right? And that when we're talking about this kind of education, education for critical thinking skills, education for assertiveness, education for taking empowering education, we're talking about certain kinds of strategies, which are very important, but they're not sufficient. That is, you need major healthcare strategies, and you also need to change the conditions under which we raise children. That is a different kind of family
policy.
But I
see no contradiction, because what we were talking about essentially was the legislation of morality, an extension of, and we're talking about what's really happening in the real world and the need for change.
Well, I don't know what you mean by legislation of morality.
For instance, the teenagers getting birth control, what they have access for, with or without parental consent, that kind of thing it goes back, should teenagers be having sex?
Right. But I think that we're very, as a society, very conflicted about it. But we're conflicted on all ages, and that teenagers have to, in effect, with the least resources of maturity and cognitive skills and money and everything else, deal with it very much on their own. And what we're saying is that there should be a whole infusion in the healthcare system and the education system of strategies that help young people.
The religious community, they're the biggest fans. My brother's a minister, and I say that all the time. But you know, what I'm saying is they really got the help, and that's what I'm telling them. You know, that they created the problem. If they had been doing their job, we wouldn't have this problem. So I'm just kind of making them feel like it's their fault. And then they've got to get out and help. And a part of helping is to help pass legislation, you know, help really go out and be supportive of things. You know, none of us support. Nobody in this room would say that I support the premarital sex. Sexuality and by youth, and I think that we need to have strategies that speak to those to parents. But part of the strategy is that they have a right. And I think it's, you know, the problem, that's part of the problem why we haven't gotten any place, is we argue so much, you know, we don't come together and decide on a rational policy to help improve the life of our children. We stay back here in this moralizing posture rather than really saying, well, you know, let's stop moralizing the issue. Let's prevent pregnancy. Let's prevent sexually transmitted disease. I mean, the reason why syphilis and GC and all of that's gone up so much, and it's gone up more in our teenagers than anybody else, is because they're out there selling sex for drugs.
But also, I mean, you know, one of the strategies for dealing with the whole question of adolescent sexuality is health care in general for adolescents. And adolescents are the most underserved population in terms of access to medical care. And to allow the whole debate to have to do with reproduction when the reality is that most adolescents need a whole range of care, that although they are not sick as frequently as young kids, if you look at the hospital discharge rates for gastroenteritis, for severe ear infections, for all the kinds of things that you expect to see in young kids, you'll see quite high rates among adolescents as well. They are still often sick, often need health care, have the most trouble getting to it. And if we talked about comprehensive health care for kids, then dealing with this sexuality has to be a piece of it.
Let's face it, the problem is not really a health problem. There are social issues that's impacting on health. You know, I mean, if we didn't have a drug problem, if we didn't, you know, if we didn't have sex and get pregnant, that wouldn't be a problem. You know, if it was, you know, that would be no different than kissing. Yeah, I mean, the consequence of sex is a pregnancy that causes poverty that keeps on, and then they get STDs that end up, you know, that's again. Then they drink alcohol and drugs and go out and wreck and kill themselves. children. And we've got to stop trying to make it a moral issue and start dealing with the social problem.
But I also think there's a difficulty in parenting adolescents that cuts through all of this as well. I mean, I think that, and especially in the new era, in the past we had the religious attitudes to fall back on, the church, synagogue, that's what you do. And now, what do? How do you parent them well? And that modeling is not really there for those of us who parent them.
See,
it really isn't. And I'm saying that black, and the work that I've done through the sisterhood, part of it is to try to help, not in just the pregnancy area, but try to help black teenage, a single mothers, first and sisters of black single mothers, to talk about how to parent. And we've done a lot of workshops for the parents on how to parent, like in general. And I think the real consequence of it is also that kids hear this confusion. Whether they want to have sex or don't want to have sex, they hear us being so confused and out there, some of it moralizing, some of it ineptness, that they can't even come to you and tell you that they have a sexually transmitted disease because they don't know what they're. I talked to an adult Indian woman yesterday. You know, we have a lot of different kinds of women coming into our community. And she said she told her mother that she was pregnant and she had a miscarriage. And her mother said, I'm going to die. And lay down on the couch and baby. I mean, so that's the kind of dilemma I think a lot of adolescents are in as they try to approach us.
Yes, but I thought when you were going to say in the past, I thought you were referring to the sexual revolution. You were referring to the past. I think of the part you were describing as the past.
Yeah,
and then the past as, right. No, but just for a minute. But there's the next part of the past is the period of women's liberation and sexual liberation pre-AIDS, prior to AIDS, and now there's the present. And I think that we are struggling with trying to communicate a message that's positive about sexuality to young people that underscores their rights to their own bodies and to pleasure, as well as the complexities of sexuality and the fact that there are many risks involved for them and that they therefore have to, it's not simple anymore. We're not saying don't have sex till you're such an age, or don't have sex till you're married, or only have sex with one person. Or, you know, I mean, all these things that were absolutes in the past, and that sort of were thrown up in the middle past, I think, now are being raised to a level in which it's much more complex. And so what you can say to kids in programs, or kids that are your kids, you know, or whatever, is a message that is very positive about their development, but which requires them to engage. It requires them to engage at a different level than they had to engage before. They have to think about themselves. Yeah.
I did a piece a while back in which I interviewed people who had grown up during sexual revolution, really identified with it, how they felt about their own children. It was fascinating because, I mean, all of these contradictions that you're talking about all came out. And it seemed to me that the main issue that everybody was completely bollocked about was separation from their children. Mm-hmm. Now, here were people who felt that their children did have a right to sexual pleasure and a right to sexual privacy. That was another thing that the kids had, their own independent lives. But because these were parents who had always, you know, talked to their kids about sex and sort of knew about their kids' sex lives in a certain way, they were in this position of being like sort of participant voyeurs in their children's sex life.
Because they didn't want to be.
Susie would come home and say, can Johnny sleep over? She's 16 years old, 17, you know. They go to a little weird schoolhouse or something. And, you know, and now the parents say, well, do I want them to go out and sleep under a bridge? No, you know, do I want them to be making out of the subway? I'd much rather have them hold safe in my apartment. But then, if they're safe in my apartment, are they having sex like under my eyes? I don't want to, you know, watch this. And so then am I condemning, am I condoning? It's in our generation, or, you know, roughly older generation, having sex was one of the ways that you became an adult, or at least.
And you separated from your parents.
Separation and individuation.
Now that's not happening. Yeah. So it's, in that sense,
totally different. And so therefore they had to sort of protect the girls and all this other stuff. And the boys were really kind of really floundering around about what to do. So, you know, these, and I kind of, this is just by way of saying that that issues of separation and self and other and the changing way that parents are involved in their children becoming adults. I mean, maybe this is something that's going to happen in a different way. Maybe you will be having sex, still being your face in your house.
There's a program also with the Women Teen Network committee called Askable Parents. Mm. What we found is that the reason parents, a lot of parents, not all, but a lot of parents are real uptight about kids and their sexuality is they themselves don't know. They're not ready for the questions. They don't know how to respond. So there's a whole education process around that so that the parents are more approachable and able to admit to themselves, well, I can't quite discuss this with you, but let me refer you to somebody who can. And then, you know, but they're open. They know more about how to deal with it when it comes at them. Very different from a parent who goes to church every Sunday, who's in the choir, blah, 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 and your daughter comes home and says, Mom, I want to go get birth control pills. What do you do? Do you pull out the Bible? I mean, how are you going to do this? So there has to be education for the parents, and you brought that up.
Yes, right.
And I found in another study, it's not really in good numbers, but that the parents who were teenage parents, you know, parents who were teenage parents, had far stricter rules.
Oh, yeah.
Far more, less likely to really, you know, be able to talk. And, you know, it was all this, if they got pregnant, I'll put them out, you know. Whereas, you know, parents who were older and who really were, you know, more mature, you know, more planned, but they were really much more likely to be open and accepting and, you know, probably none of them really said they wanted their children to have premarital sex, but they were much more likely to be accepting.
Before you alluded to kids who go out and get their own place, and they become parents, kids who stay at home. I mean, I remember reading studies about how difficult it is for a kid to be a parent and their parents home. Do you know any studies that they saw the difference?
Well, there is a lot of studies about how difficult it is to be a parent in your parents' home. And there are a lot of studies about how homeless you become if you're a teenage mother that goes out on your own. Teenage mothers who go out on their own are very likely to wind up homeless. That it's, again, another proportion. And again, we're not talking about... the majority of teen mothers, again. But most of the reason that the clearest motivation for going out on their own, or the reason given, the modal reason for giving for going out on your own, is abuse. And the other is being put out. So it, even though it's difficult to be a teenage parent with your mother, most girls don't actually set up their own household.
But you're finding that girls, the teen moms are being evicted with the baby? The grandparents aren't even keeping the baby?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they're not, they're not...
I have an SSC referral on them. you can't do that.
That's one way. But the thing that also is that
from feminist, like sisters, like mothers,
we would try to sit down and hear what the girls' issues were and then what the mothers' issues were and try to help them reconcile those issues or whether they were other family members. And the advantage of that kind of organization is that we don't have to go a legal route because sometimes, that's why I'm talking about the irrational parent. You're hysterical. You're crazy. Another mouth to feed, I thought she was in high school, and you react out of that kind of energy, and you need work so that you can calm down so that process can take place.
But I mean, if I think about the individuation things that you're talking about, it was so much clearer when pregnancy was followed by marriage in most cases, which was true until the mid-1970s for both blacks and whites, that you left home. Okay. Now, one of the reasons you probably left home, if it was anything like my house, I never had my own room. I mean, you know, who are you going to have sex with your sister in your room? You know, I mean, it's, you have two sisters in your room. It's a little bit more difficult, you know, that whole notion. So things changed. But I think in addition, when sex gets separated from
from reproduction, but when also when reproduction is separated from marriage, then it becomes less clear what the boundaries are between adults and between adulthood and youth. Right? That are you an adult? Are you a child? Are you that you're a mother, but you're also 16? You know, it's very there are a lot of complications in that.
Just a question generally in the study. When in the work, when you gave the presentation, I looked and I said, okay, one third go on welfare, two thirds, something else happened. And we jumped off on the point on everyone on welfare. And the study, I understand the basis of the study because for some reason I was forbearing monetary because I was very concerned about where their tax money is going, et cetera. So they examined the welfare cases. But my question is, how much of the results that we're getting from these studies are really saying what happens because of poverty, not really telling you about teenage pregnancy? Because two-thirds of teenage pregnancy is not even being examined.
I mean, the question of how many, what percentage of these one-third would have gone on public assistance if they waited until they were 20 anyway.
And all the results that we're getting are telling you what's the results of teenage pregnancy with poverty.
Okay.
But what do we know really about teenage pregnancy as a whole?
Okay, teenage pregnancy as a whole. And there's a million teenage pregnancies. Less than half of that result in birth. So the first thing we know about teenage pregnancy is that it's not the same thing as teenage childbearing, and that the poorer you are, the more likely that you become a teen mother as opposed to have a pregnancy during your adolescence. Then the second thing is everybody who the two-thirds who don't go on welfare are not necessarily not poor. Okay? The teenage mothers still complete less years of school and have lower incomes consistently over a 10-year period than their counterparts who don't become mothers. But I think that it is very, very difficult to separate out poverty and teenage parenthood. I think that people, you know, you can't say that age alone is a predictor or of poverty. It's this whole notion it's the same thing as trying to predict school dropout and unemployment. I mean, are you unemployed because you dropped out of school, or did you drop out of school because you already knew that you would be unemployed given that you've never seen, you know, anyone in your neighborhood get a good job or, you know, a payoff for their schooling? So, I mean, there's a whole range of things that become a part of that. I mean, I think that I mentioned, but I didn't follow up on it, the opportunity costs of delaying parenthood. This is the part where they say, well, the girl chose, she wants to have a baby, they had a baby for some reason. I have interviewed lots of teenage girls who've talked about the struggle that they've gone through to not become a teen mother when their sisters and their friends were having babies. And they were feeling left out. They were feeling like they were losing their opportunities and everything. It's not so different from what I felt in my early 20s. Everybody, my sisters, all my friends, all were having their babies when they were in their early 20s. And God, I felt like if I didn't have my first kid when I was, by the time I was 25, but I was really pushing it into, you know, middle age there. You know, that was the world that I lived in, and that maybe I wouldn't have a child. You know, you had to get married, and I mean, everybody was married, everybody was having their second kid, and you weren't. What was the experience of my friends who had a different upbringing than I did and went to a different kind of college and didn't live at home, you know, and everything, was the pull of the opportunity structure outside, that they knew that they could have this kind of job and they could go on to they knew they could go to graduate school. They knew other people who'd gone to graduate school and then had a baby, who then had children. So it was something that you could actually imagine, someone like you doing this. So I think that one of the issues that happens with teen mothers, as opposed to just girls who become pregnant, is the notion of how connected they are to an opportunity structure. outside of theirs. That's really helping them and supporting them to see that they could live in another way, because there is a cost. You lose your friends. You lose the being a part of a social network that begins to go in a particular direction.
Well, you mean if you choose not to?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you two young women that I know, actually three, who were clearly the first young women in their families to get college educations. And for all of them, there have been real difficult family consequences. I mean, in one family, I mean, it has ranged from who do you think you are to, you know, support us. I mean, and has been very difficult for her there. For one young Hispanic woman who got married early, in part because she had been abandoned as a child and got married in order to have somebody there she was related to, she got pressure from her mother, her best friend, and her husband not to be such a bookworm. She's a student at Hunter. And a third young woman who's also Hispanic, I mean, has gotten not so much a direct pressure, but just that all of her friends who are her age have babies. Some are married, some are not, but she looks around her and it takes a certain amount of ego strength to be different entirely from her peer group.
And I think it's not just ego strength. I think it's, you have to be connected. It is ego strength, but where do you get that from? I mean, it never occurred to me that I could get a doctorate when I was in college, or that I could go to law school and get married, right? Now, I graduated from college right before women took off in law school. I mean, when I graduated from college, 3% of law students were women. By the time, like 5 or 6 years later, it was up to 30%, you know, and then it was half. So it was a dramatically different time. It's because there weren't, you didn't see other women who were doing this, right?
All the other women were interpreted, because they always, like in the black community that I come from, they're always a black woman. In fact, when you look at teenage women who were teenage mothers or single mothers, there are lots of single mothers who are extremely successful. But that doesn't get interpreted as a model of success.
Okay, that's good.
It's not a failure because you don't got a man.
Right.
You may be a lawyer, or you may be supporting yourself, and that includes their mother.
Right.
You see, because if your mother is single and she has a job and she's supporting you, the teenage girl often, I think, see them. One of my assumptions, that's not being unsuccessful in getting a man, and that they're going to do it differently. I think when you talk about this issue is directly connected also to heterosexuality and marriage.
I think you're right.
That's what the girl is thinking. I have a man and a boyfriend that I love and all that. That leads somehow into pregnancy. I mean, that's the gray area. Because I think that's a critical question about who she is. She going to grow up to be a single mother, not have a man? What's going to happen to her?
And I have looked for things. I haven't found anything. And we were doing one large study in five cities about teenage sexuality. I wasn't the principal investigator, but the principal investigator was a colleague of mine, had several questions about sexual orientation on the questionnaire, and they were not allowed to ask them in any of the
See, but there's also a question there about the separation between...
You know, in the interviewing that I've done, I do have a number of lending clinics, and have, and there are, each of their life experiences is complicated. What was going on there isn't necessarily mentioned about them, but at least
there are also plenty of lesbians who have children, not because they're getting trapped in a heterosexual role, but because as women they want to have children.
I'm not talking about teenagers. I'm relating it directly to what's specifically teenagers and adult lesbians who say, I want to be a mother.
But we also have to realize that many, if you interview teen mothers, when we were doing the daycare manual, school-based child care manual, interviewing teen mothers, I don't know if you find the same thing, but it isn't as if you find lots and lots of young women who have long sexual-term sexual relationships or they were having sex for a year. I mean, people, a lot of teen mothers don't remember when this happened, or they talk about it being twice or once or twice. I mean, we're not talking about holistic sexual relationships, except for some percentage of them. That's what we would like to move toward. But for a whole range of kids, motherhood comes before sexual for a whole holistic sexuality is developed at all, or any kind of really positive, and certainly before orgasm. They always talk about it. So it's very different, Yeah.
I want to ask about adoption. You said that 1 million teen pregnancies a year and 500,000 give birth. Of those 500,000, how many?
Less than 4%. Less than 4%.
And I was wondering if anybody's done any studies on why it is so low.
No, it's basically that
a teenager.
That is a piece of the adoption. I think it's actually the flip anyway, that essentially it's not that that the change didn't come about in these huge numbers. I mean, just such big numbers, and it's less than 4%. By fears about the baby not being adopted as much as by the availability of abortion, which meant that you had to make some choice at some point about going through with the pregnancy. And so you could make the choice not to go through with the pregnancy without it being illegal and more difficult than it was in the past. And secondly, that you had models of single mothers. I mean, teenage single mothers are dealing with the issue of whether they can become and can function as a teenage single mother, but it isn't as if they haven't seen any other single mothers. I mean, at the point that I was divorced and had one child and was 26, I realized women's roles had changed enough that you were in the workforce, you could function, you didn't have to go back home or, somehow, and that was in the mid-70s, somehow protect this, right? Be protected. And so I think girls saw that then. So what's the big difference between having been married and being divorced with a year-old baby or being single? So that's it. We should finish up, I guess. They need to get...
I wanted to make one comment. The fact that the two of us are in such disagreement about this very fundamental issue of whether a black baby will end up being adopted.
Put it up for adoption. because adoption is seen, first of all, until fairly recently, black children were mistreated through the adoption process.
Right.
And they were racially segregated and all that.
True.
So people
absolutely
didn't do it. There is now, even with white parents wanting black babies, there's still, even with black parents wanting black babies, there's still large percentages compared to black children who do not get adopted. So even if I say I'm going to have this baby and I can't deal with it, the last place that I will be both advised by my parents and community, and even in my own head, is put them up for adoption. Because they will not deny
the adoption.
But you're raising another issue that has not that much to do with teen mothers.
But it's very important for teen mothers.
It's not that important.
They think that they have no opportunity to place their
kids. But I just said they don't. Our community doesn't feel that that's a real option for black children, black women to put up their children for adoption.
Let me just throw out one more thing. I was told by the black social worker that there were plenty of black parent families waiting, praying for black babies.
But again, I just said,
now,
we don't feel that's what we want to do with the children that we have, that we give birth to. In our community, even if she's 15 and she's my child, she has a baby, and I hate her and I hate the baby and all that, I don't think that that's the option that she should, I don't think that's what she should do.
So it's not.
So within our community, we don't feel, well, there is a question of race. I mean, there is widespread people do not want white parents, white families adopting black children. There's
but
I'm saying that, if I'm saying now that the deeper question, and I would suspect also the Latino families, that we don't want the children to go out there into this unknown institutional adoption. And that has to be respected for
black people.
Yeah.
Or
because you don't know what they're
going to go to before they even get to a black family, because the institution, you know, might not be friendly.
I don't want my children, my blood over there. Right. If somebody said, we're going to try to take care of ourselves, or she's got to take care of herself, or go to the boy's family. But I'm not putting the child into that process.
Yeah, that's kind of public. I mean,
that's
real clear. The context that we have is public institutions.
But it doesn't have to be a public institution. It could be a private adoption agency.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to think about the way you perceive institutions is the way other people perceive institutions.
Oh, I perceive institutions just as hostily as they do.
No, I don't. I'm not
personally, but as a white person, you know, you might personally be hostile to public institutions as hostile as X other person who's not white. But the way the institution perceives you, before they know how much you hate them, they see that you're white and they're going to treat you differently.
Believe me.
And you have to go through the system.
No.
As a community of white women, so your community doesn't view institutions the way the black community views institutions and corporations.
And vice versa.
Putting a little input into something like that is really not a choice.
But institutional adoption is not the only adoption.
Yeah, but think about how private agency. Private
it's also an informal adoption. I'm the one, I'll take the baby.
Private agencies right now also are not places where people are giving babies, because private agencies ask you to abandon the baby with the expectation that it will get a good home. And depending on who you are, you will have a different expectation that it will get a good home.
Well, thank you very much. We can continue.
I didn't get any sheets yet. Is there any?
We have a pink page. Oh, yeah.